We're at the Four Seasons Biltmore in Santa Barbara at the Paul F. Glenn Symposium on the Biology of Aging, actually a genetic and molecular basis of longevity and aging, with Gordon Lithgow, who's from the Buck Institute, who's actually technically a professor of molecular genetics and the chemical biology of aging. How does your research fit into the overall context of this meeting?
Well, like many people here, we're interested in the determinants of longevity and principally the genetic determinants. What are the genes? What are the proteins? What are the physiological pathways that they are then involved in that determine outcomes for aging, both longevity and other aging phenotypes?
And you work on Caenorhabditis elegans,
yes.
The famous worm, of course. Most of the work of yours that I've read has been involved in the effects of heat stress on the worm and showing that a little stress is good for you. I mean, could you elaborate on that? That was rather a compressed version. So
yes, we became interested in heat stress way back in the days when there was only a few aging mutations around in the mid-90s. And we realized that the long-lived mutants, those worms destined to be long-lived, as young animals were resistant to thermal stress. And it was exciting for us because a lot was known about the molecular biology of thermal stress and the response of an animal to thermal stress. And we realized that perhaps there was some mechanistic commonality between the way an animal responds to stress and what happens during aging. And it's something that I think has become somewhat of a paradigm that the animals that you make resistant to stresses of various types tend to be long-lived. And I think it really says something about the nature of aging itself as a chronic stress, and the types of biochemical and physiological changes you see during aging are mimicking in some ways the types of things you see during more acute stresses.
Science, of course, is a moving target, and you're always responding to new information and so on. But I tend to ask people from these meetings, we've talked to a lot of people now, are there some sort of givens that you operate with? Are there some basic models that you subscribe to, some basic ideas that you subscribe to as you forge ahead? Do you think we have a use-by date, a limited lifespan? Can it be increased almost indefinitely? What are the parameters that you work within?
I think the last 20 years have told us that we shouldn't be thinking about parameters and limits, and that we work best when we forget what we think we know and open our minds to really what we absolutely do not know. And we all have our intellectual baggage that we bring with us, and this notion of a mechanistic relationship with stress is something that in many of the experiments in my lab is there. It's interwoven into the types of approaches, but it's wonderful when your young trainees come along with an idea that's completely out the box and just wants to give it a whirl, and that's where the breakthroughs come from.
So let's just unpack that point a little bit, because you wrote a paper about why aging isn't regulated, and you used the phrase after the colon, it said, a lamentation on the use of language in aging literature. Mm-hmm. So would you like to remind us what you were getting at?
Yeah, that was a commentary on a debate that was going on within the community, and I don't think it's resolved yet. And the debate really is as to whether aging is a programmed event, something that's been selected by Darwinian natural selection to occur for the benefit of genes being passed on to the next generation. Is aging good for you in that respect? And the other view is, of course, that aging is really irrelevant to whether genes are passed on to the next generation or not. And aging is essentially an evolutionary baggage that comes along with selection for early life events, reproduction, growth, and so on. And there's really two types of people come to that argument, and I characterized them fairly viciously on both sides as the tree-hugging evolutionary biologists who can't quite see the most incredible things that have happened within the molecular biology of aging, and then the more developmental, Ferrari-driving molecular biologists on the other hand who didn't quite see the validity of the evolutionary argument. So it was really just to unpack some of the words that we use around aging, such as regulated and what we mean by regulated, and to ask the question again, what's the evolutionary origins of this process? And I think it's really important to know. I think that's going to tell us something about the way forward when we start intervening in aging pathways. I think we need to know why those pathways are there and the evolutionary history of those pathways.
That's an awfully big, tall order. As I was watching Brian Kennedy's talk there, just in there, and he actually, there was a phrase he used somewhere, which was the, he talked about the new sets of dependencies on downstream effector pathways, which basically meant that there was a huge graph there with lots of lines on it, and yes. you can't do just one thing in there. So, do you feel optimistic about it? How tractable an issue is this? Obviously, you'd be doing it, you wouldn't be doing it otherwise.
No, but I feel very optimistic. I mean, what we've gone through is a stage where, for the most part, we've held the environment constant and examined the action of specific genes on longevity in those environments, whether it be the very clean animal house, whether it be the petri dishes with the worms crawling around on E. coli, constant. And we've looked for consistency from lab to lab, and we've tried to find reproducible results in that way. Right. Now, what we find is there's actually a lot of inconsistency in the aging literature. There's a lot of conflicting reports. And that reflects the fact that genes don't work in a single environment. And as soon as you change the environment, different sets of genes play out in different ways. And what Brian was also saying was that once you introduce one genetic mutation, the way that affects how another genetic mutation is going to influence aging is really quite profound. So there's a great deal of complexity in the way that the genes interact with environments for aging outcomes, and the way that genes interact with each other for aging outcomes. So there's a lot there that we've really got to nail down. And in no way does it disparage the work that's been done to date, where we've tried to hold the environment constant. But it does say that the more that we spread out from those models and those environments and start looking at different diets and different conditions and different combination of genes, the more we're going to learn about what aging means for us walking around in a very complex environment with a very complex genetic variation.
There's 2 points emerge from that. One's a small commentary on it, and second, a larger point, which is a question to you. The smaller commentary would be that Bruce Yankner was saying in response to Brian's talk, well, you know, the caloric restriction, dietary restriction regimes used in model organisms and so on, how realistic is that when you take things out into the wild, into natural circumstances with natural selective forces on them? How relevant is that? Maybe we should deal with that first.
Well, I think that the truth will out. So there's a really good example where we go from genetic pathways defined in model organisms in completely artificial environments, nothing like the real environment for what we know that them to be. But you take those genes and you go to the human genetic epidemiologists and you say, is there any evidence that these genes are playing out in successful aging in human populations? Mm-hmm. You cut to the chase. And I think that there's evidence beginning to emerge that some of these major pathways, like insulin signaling and TOR, are playing out in human longevity in interesting ways.
This is my second larger point. The notion of model organisms and conveying to a larger public that, yes, one of the only ways you can do the science is to hold things constant and do controls and so on and use model organisms. But then there are people saying, well, but how is that relevant to humans? And I just came from a meeting, which was a celebration for Mike Bishop's tenure at UC San Francisco, and we were talking about cancer. Mark Kirshner was there, various people. And this same thing had come up that was mentioned in the meeting this morning, that the national institutes are under some pressure, National Cancer Institute in that case, National Institute of Aging in this particular case, to deliver human results.
Yes.
And therefore it's sometimes difficult to convince people that working on yeast, elegans, flies, mice is as relevant as people in that room think it is. So could you comment on that as well?
Yes, and it's always been a challenge. I think it always will be a challenge. But what we see time after time is a commonality in the mechanisms, the fundamental mechanisms at play in model organisms and the mechanisms at play in ourselves, and particularly in relation to age-related disease. I mean, all of these genes that everyone's talking about in the room there, all of these genes that we hear about in all the aging conferences, you take a step back and you look at them as human genes, and you realize that most of them are involved in human disease in some way, age-related disease. And I think there's a profound body of evidence now that suggests that the genes that we're looking at in model organisms have a role in human aging, and in particular in human age-related disease, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cancer, osteoarthritis, and so on. So whilst it's always going to be difficult to show a politician or an administrator at the highest level a worm or a yeast cell and tell them that something profound is happening in there that affects their lives, I think the stories are beginning to develop. I think we can really show that you can go from these organisms to clinical trials on agents that affect longevity, and really the proof of the pudding is there now. I don't think we need to apologize for these systems anymore.
Right. Just to go back to something you were talking about earlier, it was a kind of a Tom Kirkwood perspective, and you have written papers with Tom, I think, right? And again, just to sort of give you a cartoon version, there is this conflict between the story which is reproduce, get your genes into the next generation, you're not needed now, you can die, and maintaining lifespan for all sorts of other reasons as well. And so there's these conflicts between the two, reproductive strategy and the longevity story. Have we reached an accommodation on that? Just to go back to the point you made earlier.
I don't think we've quite reached an accommodation. I find it compelling that the evolutionary biologists have reached a point where they feel comfortable in a general notion of aging as a non-adaptive process. Now, that's not to say that there won't be aspects of aging pathology or aging phenotypes that we have to look at again, but I don't characterize it as a major conflict or a major paradox between the types of things we're seeing in labs, in vast increases in longevity by manipulating very, very few genes. I don't really see a major conflict there, because these are important genes in other ways. They're important genes in growth and development, something Gary Rufkin just touched on. These are important genes in processes in which an animal is able to modulate its metabolism in response to the environment. These are there for that purpose. And somehow, for me, it's not surprising that then they would have large effects on longevity as well, because you're changing every aspect of an animal's physiology when you modulate some of these endocrine pathways. Now, that's different from saying, well, is the purpose of these genes in the wild to regulate lifespan? I think that's a separate question, and that's one perhaps best left to the evolutionary biologists. But is it surprising for molecular and cellular biologists that these genes have massive effects on lifespan? I don't think it should be, because they have massive effects on physiology.
Could you unpack this notion of checkpoint proteins for us? Because this is a term that's very much associated with you, and it's not dissimilar to the point we've just been making, which is that you end up with these proteins that are active in cells that divide and that don't divide, so you have this dual functionality.
Yes.
And so there are genetic variations that put some at risk, and in other cases set others on a kind of shorter but cancer-free lifespan.
So possibly, that's possibly an idea, so, but we don't know that for a fact.
Yeah. So could you just speak to that?
The checkpoint proteins are very well characterized by cancer biologists as proteins vital to arrest cell division when a cell suffers damage, principally DNA damage. And the checkpoints are part of a much larger system of DNA repair, of a decision in cell fate as to whether to commit suicide, to divide again, or importantly, to become senescent. The senescent cell, which is, we believe, an evolutionary adaptant to prevent early cancer. And there's growing body of evidence now that all of those processes are involved in prevention of cancer, but they also play out in various ways during aging. And Judy Campisi has highlighted this in a very lucid way, in that the mechanisms that drive cells into senescence also create a situation which allows a tissue to become cancer prone in late life. So something that's advantageous to prevent childhood cancers creates problems in tissues in late life that make cancer more likely.
This is the whole notion of pleiotropy.
And that's a classic example of antagonistic pleiotropy in aging, where you select for something beneficial in early life, there are detrimental effects in late life that we're just beginning to understand.
So where do you see the primary acupressure points at this point as people move forward I'm thinking about now people who are sitting at home wondering how they can live longer and have a extended health span. Where are the primary points of engagement now?
My great hope is that all of the ferment in the curiosity-driven research in the biology of aging, and that's what it is, you know, young people out there finding new genes and finding new pathways and trying to link them to physiology. My hope is that that body of knowledge in explaining what normal aging is going to allow us to see what the early events are in age-related disease. That the notion of a healthy lifespan, I think, will come from us understanding what are the very earliest events in the human brain that leads to Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. What's the earliest events in other tissues that lead to cancer? And so I think that's where this field is heading, and we're seeing that evidence is emerging that when you intervene in aging pathways, as they're called, in other words, you extend lifespan, you also see benefits in the offsetting age-related diseases. The classic example is caloric restriction and the effect on cancer in mice, where cancer is either postponed or in some cases done away with altogether. So I think that's the great hope. The great hope is that the biology of aging morphs into understanding most of the disease conditions that are the major challenges for the 21st century.
Yeah, now it seems to me that this, and this is exemplified by the Buck Institute, your home institute, this calls for major interdisciplinary, non-silo engagement.
I believe so, yes.
And you're the director, I think, of, or the group leader of the Geroscience Consortium.
That's correct, yeah. And we made up this word geroscience to try and convey that there's an interface between normal aging and disease.
Right.
And you're right, you know, traditionally we studied human diseases in silos. There's the National Cancer Institute. You know, that there are individual departments and individual institutes devoted to particular disease states. But since aging is the major causal factor for all of these diseases, you might think it may be a good idea to go back and look for commonality in the earliest events. And that's what we call geroscience, is trying to understand those earliest events by bringing the biology of aging to it. You know, it's funny that, you know, you can go to many, many cancer institutes and you won't find any expertise on aging at all. The largest causal factor for the disease, and there's no expertise on that process. So I hope that we're going to see some changes there, and essentially what's happened within the NIA and the biology of aging program within the NIA is going to burst out and really reach into the different institutes at the NIH, and we're really going to see aging placed at the center of studying many, many disease states.
One of the interesting things I heard in there with some of the historical background that the folks were talking about, which goes back to, you know, when Paul Glenn first started getting interested in this whole sort of area, and then there was the initial papers started coming out. But the folks at the institutes, Gary Ruvkin was making the point that they were betting on horses there. There was no really major, reliable area that would satisfy government accountants, if you like. They were just saying, that looks like a good scientific paper, let's get something into there. Yeah. It was sort of surprising to think that in fact risks were being taken at that kind of...
No, it's a wonderful history of people risking their careers, both on the admin side and on the scientist side.
Yeah.
And the earliest pioneers, and, you know, the Tom Johnsons and the Michael Roses, I mean, these guys were not held in great respect by their colleagues at their universities until you started to see this field emerging, and still it's blossomed in the last 20 years. You know, I think there's a lot of work to be done there, though, because the NIA, as you know, the admin people would tell you, the NIA budget has been flat for many, many years now. Mm-hmm. So here's a field that's exploded across all the major journals. You know, wonderful new careers, a great cadre of young investigators brought into this field. The funding hasn't increased.
So there's a huge amount of funding, I've said this to other people, there's a huge amount of funding for the treatment of diseases.
Yes.
and an almost pitifully small amount of money going into research that would help you understand the genesis of the diseases.
Yeah, we estimate that something like 0.1% of the NIH budget goes to the type of science that we think could provide a new way to look at human disease, and that's through the biology of aging. 0.1%? I think we can do better there, and it's not to denigrate the other science that's going on. It's not that the traditional approaches to Alzheimer's and so on isn't great science and may yield results. It's just that I think this is potentially a really interesting way to look at this, and it may really pay off big. And one of the ways it might pay off, and you hear this being talked about quite frequently now, is that therapies that are focused on aging are likely to be effective across multiple disease states. If you have common causes or common mechanisms that in some tissues fire cancer, in other tissues fire neurodegenerative disease, then what happens if you attack that common point? You may see benefits across a much wider range of diseases than the traditional approach of looking at single targets, single proteins involved in particular pathologies for single diseases.
Right. So you're talking about a systems biology approach?
Or? Well, it's systems biology, certainly, and that's going to be a big part of this interdisciplinary feel to this, but it's everyone else, you know. It's your reductionist chemists, it's your molecular biologists. Everyone has a place at the table here. We can't do it without the fundamental genetics. We can't do it without the physiologists explaining what's going on in the animals when we tweak the genes. And we can't do it without the expertise in disease pathologies telling us what the earliest events are and telling us what to look for as we go forward. I mean, it has to be a coming together of different people in different disciplines.
As you look back, I mean, what was your trajectory into this whole, even into science? Mm. I mean, where did you grow up?
Oh, I grew up in Motherwell in Scotland, a steel town. And as I was going through high school, it was either go to university or sign on the dole. It was very high unemployment as the steelworks were closing down. And I was very fortunate enough to go off to Strathclyde and then Glasgow University and become very enamored with genetics. I always liked biology. You know, I was a bird watcher when I was a kid. And I was looking around at the end of my PhD for something that was a big question. What were the great unsolved mysteries in molecular biology? And there was very little on aging. There was nothing on aging, actually. In fact, I went off to do a postdoc on something completely different. But the seed was planted that there could be some interesting biology around this notion of aging. No one was studying it, and I was floored.
Do you remember what the genesis of that little spark was? I mean,
no, and it wasn't as some of my colleagues have been fascinated with aging since they were kids, since they looked at the skin on their grandmother's hands, yeah, and things. And that wasn't it for me. I was just looking for something that was unsolved, a big question that nobody was working on, and and there was one other thing, and that was I had a lecturer as an undergraduate, Johnny Johnson, and he, along with Bob Mortimer, were the first in the 50s to show that a single-celled Saccharomyces cerevisiae had an aging paradigm. They were the first to see that there was a number of daughter buds came off, and then the cell granulated and died. And so hearing that, yeah, this was yeast. And everyone was doing yeast genetics. I thought, well, why is no one doing genetics on that? And of course, by the time I got around to being able to do that myself, some people were. Mike Jovinsky was doing it. But my big moment was reading one of Tom Johnson's papers. It was a 2000 paper on age one, showing a change in the rate of aging, the Gompertz rate. And I read that paper and thought, oh, this is it. You can study aging the way that people have been studying development. You can study aging the way that people have been looking at homeiotic genes. And that was me. I went off to Tom's lab at that point.
It has to be said, of course, that he was not universally lauded at that moment. Mm-hmm. People just think, what is this?
Mm-hmm. I mean, no, so it was very tough for people, especially those people who were versed in the evolutionary biology arguments of aging. There was no prediction there that single gene mutations would have large effects on lifespan. No prediction at all. I think it was very, very difficult for people to grasp it. And actually, I really think it took others to come into the field and other genes and Cynthia's discovery of DAF2 to really say, you know, this is real. This can happen. A very tiny effect, one gene out of 19,000 in a nematode, you can tweak it and you get a doubling of lifespan, as Cynthia showed. Remarkable.
So you found yourself in Colorado?
Yes, and really I've always had that curiosity-driven angle on this, that I just wanted to understand why aging happened, why mice live 2 years and elephants live 50 years, and why the worm lived 18 days. What's really surprised me is the last 5 or 6 years, and partly this has been at the Buck Institute, where the guy in my next office is a breast cancer specialist. You know, the guy down here works on mitochondria. The person over there works on Parkinson's.
And that would be Julie Anderson.
Yeah, Julie Anderson. And realizing actually that we're all working on the same stuff. Right. That was remarkable. And seeing the commonality of the types of mechanisms we're looking at, and realizing that, of course, just look at the list of aging genes. These are the genes that are involved in human disease as well. And so for the first time, I was getting beyond just simply the curiosity, basic research, and thinking, this could be really useful. This approach of combining the biology of aging with the expertise in specific disease states could really create something very, very useful. And I think we're seeing it. I think people are talking about translating their findings all over the place now. And some of the most careful, cautious, basic scientists are now saying it's time. It's really time to invest in this area and see what's possible.
So what do you think the take home, I mean, I haven't got them with me now, but the magazine covers Up the Kazoo, having to live longer, being 100, all these sorts of things. General articles for general public, but they do seem to boil down to what your grandmother told you, to some extent, you know. Essentially, lengthen your telomeres and skip dessert, but eat healthy, exercise, all those sorts of things. What is the science bringing to the picture that's new?
Well, one of the new things, I think, is the science behind some of those notions, and some of them have been notions for a while, is quite profound. So that when you start to be able to measure the effects of exercise on, for example, aging gene transcript profiles, you know, as my colleague Simon Meloff showed, that you can reverse aging trends in skeletal muscle by exercise, you go, aha, there's mechanism here. So I think that helps the basic scientists get out of their comfort zone and start saying, you know what, there's a lot to this stuff, and we need to understand it at a deeper level so that we can really capture the benefits from either healthy eating, exercise, capture those benefits and turn them into ways to attack disease states. So yes, I think we're always going to tell people it's much better to get out there and exercise. We're always going to tell people to eat what is the healthy diet of the day, because that's the state of our knowledge. And it's very important that the nutritionists are some of the people at the table as well. But just think, if we had a deep molecular understanding of the impact of exercise, the impact of diet on aging phenotypes, that may actually throw up ways to combat age-related disease. And as you know, there's no amount of exercise and healthy eating is going to eradicate Alzheimer's. There may be some benefits. We're interested in eradication. We're interested in cures and complete preventions. And I think a way to go is to capture this information, this good stuff, and really focus in on what it's doing.
What people are looking for, to a large extent, though, there's a whole big pharma industry out there, is stuff you can take to make you live longer. So things are being explored, like rapamycin, for example. And obviously there's downsides to that. It's very early days at this point. This is something which is usually used in transplants to tamp down the effects of the immune system, which is not an effect you'd really want. But from Brian's talk, it's clear that there are some interesting developments in that area now. I mean, do you have a sense that what we're looking for here is medical interventions or pharmacological interventions?
I think we're looking for information that allow people to make good choices about their own life. The exercise, the diet, I think it's important. I think that's a component of what we're doing. Prevention is always better than cures in that regard. But I don't think we should shy away from cures. You know, I feel sometimes like it's the beginning of the 19th century and we're saying, you know, tuberculosis is a terrible thing and polio is a terrible thing, and if only we built more sanitariums and more iron lungs, we could really do something great here to alleviate things. You know, and in the end, what made the difference was cures. Right. So I don't think we should shy away from that. I think we're getting to a point where, again, it's getting out of our comfort zone, but we should be getting to a point where we're talking about choices to be made based on the investments we make in the science. And maybe the choices are, do we want to have Alzheimer's around by 2040? Do we want to have adult cancers around by 2040, 2050? Maybe the science is at a point where we could start talking about cures and driving down that road.
Yeah.
So I think it's both.
Okay. In terms of your own trajectory and the importance of science as a way of knowing in your life, I've been asking people a question which is based on the president's inaugural address and then a speech he gave at the National Academies later, where he talked about his administration restoring science to its rightful place.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't exactly give any coordinates, but
yes.
So what do you think the rightful place of science is in a society like this?
I suspect you're getting quite similar replies from people. I think that science is, I would find it very difficult to underestimate the benefits that could be derived from scientific knowledge. The way that that's turned into technology is important in many aspects. But I mean, even if we just confine ourselves to talking about medical science, and of course I think the bigger issues perhaps are environmental sciences and the impacts there, but even if we just talk about medical sciences, we've just gone through a torturous healthcare debate where the most profoundly difficult debating and politicking has been going on around an issue which science could cut through to a certain extent. The healthcare debate has been driven in most part by aging. It's the cost of aging that is on the table here. It's the eradication or alleviation of symptoms and long-term care that's the problem. Now, I didn't hear anyone talk about the science of aging in that whole healthcare debate. I didn't really hear science much. And that's a shame, you know. We heard some very big numbers in terms of expenditures. And we hear very small numbers as it relates to studying the basic processes at play. And I think that if the scientific agenda profile can be raised, eventually you'll start to hear that. You'll start to hear congressmen and senators say, yes, we have to put in place the provision for what's about to happen to our society with the demographic change. But we should also think about putting in place some funding for science that could offset that. And the numbers are astronomical. You know, cures for Alzheimer's and adult cancers, these numbers are astronomical. Incredible benefits could accrue from focusing on the science. So that's just the medical science, and that's just aging.
Yeah, I had some numbers that's essentially said that almost over 50% of the nation's medical bill, in a sense, was could be laid to two things: the final year of life and diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these are diet, nutrition, metabolism related issues, obviously, because diet's plainly hugely involved in the diabetes story.
Yes.
And the costs of that final year are often the result of lifestyle changes. Lifestyle changes could improve that.
Absolutely.
So that there weren't such astronomical costs at the end. So.
Absolutely.
So one of the things that we try and do in having these conversations is to raise the sort of public awareness of some of these issues so that when you are making a decision about a health bill, you're doing it with an informed, mm-hmm. you know, with some information.
Absolutely. And you know, and the hard basic science and the expenditure there, again, should not offset efforts in education and in changing behaviors. Very difficult, of course, as we know. Changing human behaviors is incredibly difficult. All the social pressures that come to play on individuals who put themselves at risk through diet and lack of exercise. But really, we have to be working there as well.
Yeah. Some of the younger scientists I've spoken to were bemoaning the fact that the funding had gone down and that they were worried that they might be a sort of a lost generation of
yes.
scientists. You will have young people coming into your lab and so on. You have friends who are considering doing this as a career. What's your advice to a young scientist?
Be excellent. it's getting down to the 5% and the 95%. And if you're in the 5%, you'll have a wonderful career in science, and it'll be very enjoyable and very rewarding. And we should never let that go. This is the best job in the world. This is just incredible. And what they've got to do is so important. The 95s will, in the immediate future, will struggle for funding. And it's terrible. And some wonderful, wonderful scientists will not be able to do what they should do and realize their potential. And so at the moment, the advice is always do the best experiments, always think out of the box, always improve, always talk to people, collaborate, go to the best people, go to the best minds. So that's always the advice, but now more than ever, because that is their passport to what little resources there are to go around at the moment.
It's hard though to, in your case, where you were talking about, you actually were looking at a nascent field, and for some reason had the wit to see that there was a new avenue there. I mean, a lot of the science that's being done, a lot of the way, the whole ethos of science, and I watch people coming into the Salk and so on, is to get the job done so that they can get the next job, to get the next job, yes, get the next job. It's very difficult because of the funding process. So I don't know how that gets resolved. If large institutions like Howard Hughes, which is already funding investigators, and the Wellcome is now funding investigators, it's very difficult for younger scientists to find a pot of money out there that allow them to be inspired, exploratory, and so on.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And yes, there are some mechanisms that try to do that. But I agree. And it's actually, I think it's the responsibility of us all. And actually, we heard David Finkelstein this morning chiding us, saying, get out and tell people and at study section everywhere else that basic science is important. And I would extend that to saying risky science is important. And actually, I secretly quite like it when review committees come back to me and say, those pilot projects that you funded aren't going very well, are they? They haven't really turned into big grants. And then you go, that's okay. That's what it's about. That's, you know, where possible, where we have control over resources, and we put it to young people, and we put it to risky science and new ideas. That's a personal responsibility for everyone in the field.
Yeah. I mean, this is the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society. This would mean something to you since you come from UK. And I think about this longest uninterrupted scientific enterprise on the planet and all that has come out of there, there's something really uplifting about that. And I've been asking people, if I gave them a token for time travel, who would they like to have? Who would they like to talk to? It doesn't have to be just scientists, but anybody in history that you'd like to have to a dinner party so you could ask them questions or just quiz them on what they were thinking about. How on earth did you have that idea? Any of your great heroes that you'd like to have a conversation?
Well, you know, I'd like to talk to Rosalind Franklin. You know, because there's so many different ways in which that story is portrayed about how was she really missing the importance of DNA as portrayed in some stories, or was she just as clued into it as anyone else, as Watson and Crick and so on. To talk to Franklin about why did she take on that problem? Once in that problem, did she see the significance of it? What did she think about everything that was going on around her and the way it eventually played out? That would be amazing. You can organize that, can you?
Oh, I absolutely. There That's was it's just a quick channeling. Just channeling. I was back in UK a couple of weeks ago for a meeting at the Royal Society, and there was a centennial celebration that day for Dorothy Hodgkin, which raised the issue of women in science. There was a nice little booklet being produced by one of the fellows there, which was about mothers in science. It showed 64 mothers who were doing science and so on. So the whole notion of being in science as a woman is still an issue. I ask female scientists about this all the time. I hate even having to use the term, but it seems to be still a real issue. And the advice that one can give, your situation, for example. You know full well, working with women scientists and so on. Do you have any advice, or does that Julie's ever passed on to you about the about being a?
I think that Julie, my wife, Julie Anderson, that I think every few days, Julie will mention something that you listen to and you think that's something that's unique, not to Julie but to women in science. Very small things. Not the big things of the past, perhaps. Very small things. You just think that's odd. That's a unique thing there, the way that someone interprets what another scientist says about their hypothesis. Sometimes I think is seen through a lens that we should be maybe more aware of.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Still, I read a piece, obviously, that there was in The Scientist some years ago about, I think it was called In Sickness and in Health was the title, about the benefits and the downsides of being a married couple working in science. I mean, any further commentary on that?
I think at the time we both said it's delightful, you know, that there's a great upside to it, that, you know, that the understanding of each other's careers and pressures and occasionally the pure fun and just being able to talk about science, you know, with your spouse, it's great. And we don't talk science every night, certainly not, but that is a big upside. And you know, there are the other little pressures. And obviously, you know, that this is something that involves travel, it involves coming to wonderful meetings like this, but now, you know, Julie's at home and we have a son, and there's added pressures come from that. So I don't know, I'd recommend it.
Yeah. What are you optimistic about in this field? Or in general?
I think Italy might win the World Cup. I'm not sure about that. But beyond that, I know. But that's how everyone reacted last time around.
Did you grow up as an avid soccer fan then?
I'm actually more a rugby fan. So I'm not optimistic that Scotland's going to beat Argentina on Saturday. I don't think that's going to happen. That'd be nice though. You've got to be optimistic in this field. Come on. I mean, this, every single time someone gets up on a platform these days, there's new information. There's information that's consistent with things that have gone on. I mean, you know, some people describe aging as paradox-free still. We still haven't nailed down a central paradox. But I don't know. I think there's a coming together of lots of different strands here. And yes, it's complex. Yes, it's going to take a lot of more science, a lot more people coming to the table. But I think it's remarkable what's going on. So I'm very optimistic. I'm very optimistic that we'll see breakouts. That, you know, whether it's the rapamycin or the resveratrol, we'll see breakouts where something from the basic sciences very quickly goes into a different domain, whether it's biotech or whether it's translational clinical research. And the rest of us, hopefully, will continue to do the basic research. Hopefully, there's going to be a place. There is. There's going to be a place for people studying yeast and worms for many, many years to come. But we'll see these breakouts, and they're going to have an impact out there. And that's going to create a whole new atmosphere in how we think about aging, how we think about aging research, and how we think about human disease. And going back to your point about diseases in silos, that's, you know, I can't see it yet. I wish I could do it. I can't see how we're going to break them down, but I'm optimistic that those silos are going to be broken down.
Have you found it difficult to communicate to a general audience, to media? I'm not just you, but I mean the general way of trying to get information out there, in the sense that there's a certain requirement to deliver certitude and revolutionary breakthrough and so on and so forth, and you know, and I know perfectly well, that's not how this works. I mean, there's a lot of plodding goes on, a lot of reversals and so on. Do you think that there could be some better way of communicating I'm not saying there is a scientific method, but the techniques, the strategies, the methodology of science would make it a bit easier for a general public to understand.
Yeah,
why.
Well, and you know the debate that's going on at the moment about the climate scientists and the mess that's gone on there in communicating very certain science, and I think they're asking themselves how did this go so badly. We must search for a new model to communicate some certainties within a science and still not lose the soul of the scientific method and the fact that we still do present theories when we go forward to the public. Something still is a theory. I have no special angle on this, I'm afraid. I wish I did. I think that at best science is conveyed by people who are excited about it. And I find that when I'm given a little bit of time, it's a lengthy argument. It's a lengthy argument to say studying yeast and worms and flies and so on will somehow lead to therapies. It's more than a one sentence. It's not a five-word pitch. It takes a little bit of time. But once you go down that road and you've got 10 minutes or 15 minutes with a group of people with no information at all, no scientific understanding, you can generally see the excitement. You can generally see that they pick it up. So it takes, you know, of course it would be wonderful if suddenly we had a fantastically scientifically literate public and people could understand scientific speak and it would just be a direct one-to-one, here's the journals, make up your own mind. There's interpretation by the scientists, there's interpretation by media and communicators of science. But it seems the one thing that cuts through and helps that grease the way is the excitement.
Do you ever consider doing anything else than being a scientist?
I have in the past. I certainly as a postdoc, when things are hard and you've done your 99th experiment in a row that didn't go well, you definitely think about other things.
What do you think you would have liked to have possibly could have done as another enterprise?
I mean, I have no talent, but I'd love to have been a professional musician or professional cricketer. photography, but I'm incredibly fortunate, as I say, that the generation of kids I went to school with, most of them spent their first two or three years post 18 years old on the dole, and I was incredibly lucky to not have to go through that experience. So I don't lie awake wondering if I should have done something else very often.
So what's your next, what are your next few experiments? I mean, your passion for the next few years, and how will you know if you've achieved it?
We're incredibly excited about a couple of different things. One, understanding how all these genes that we're hearing about impact on protein homeostasis and how proteins are made, turned over, degraded. You know, the fates of proteins, I think, might be quite important. And one of the reasons is that we see that when that goes wrong, neurodegenerative disease is one of the big outcomes. So I think there's a lot in common between what goes on in normal aging and the way proteins are handled and what goes wrong in neurodegenerative disease. So that's something that we have interest in. And we're beginning to think that we can modulate protein homeostasis with chemicals. And the hope there is, of course, that would eventually lead to drugs that would improve the way that cells deal with events that go wrong with protein folding and protein conformation.
That sounds almost counterintuitive to a non-scientist, in the sense that when you talk about homeostasis, you're about talking about trying to keep things regulated at a fairly level, golden mean, as it were, almost. But you're also know from your work and other work that challenging the system.
Yes.
Can produce improvements in longevity and so on. So that's disturbing the situation.
Disturbing it, and I think it goes back to, you know, we keep coming back with things that our grandmothers told you, and what doesn't kill you makes you stronger is the one in this case. And the types of stresses or interventions that perturb the system, but then somehow you see benefits from it. You see extension in lifespan in worms and flies, for example, if you stress them early in life. They don't kill the animals. They don't deliver a lethal stress. They deliver a level of stress that makes the animal respond. And the response, the endogenous response, the genes and proteins are turned off and turned on as a result of experiencing that stress. Those are the ones that give you benefit, those events. And it kind of makes sense, because what the animal's trying to do is get back to homeostasis, saying, well, bad stuff's happening and the environment's changing. We've got to hunker down and find a new way, new metabolism. We've got to repair, we've got to maintain things. So you go into that state where you're responding to change to try and bring you back to the homeostatic center. Now, having done that, if you meet a major challenge later on, like aging, you're better able to cope with it. So that's why we see commonality in stress response and things that benefit you in late life, is that some of those changes in aging are quite like the changes you see if you apply an acute stress.
Well, but so how would you consider actually applying that to a real life strategy of somebody? What kind of stresses, I mean, could you imagine, and when would you deliver them to a human being going from birth onwards? I mean, how do you actually apply that?
Well, I don't know. And actually, I think we're beginning to really think about this seriously for the first time. And
having gone through those challenges, your later life will be less disease ridden.
That's right. And I don't think this is a stretch. This may be what exercise does, right?
Right.
That much of the response to exercise is a response to oxidative or physiological stress that then delays aging, that slows down those degenerative processes later on, or changes the stem cell pool in a way that activates them ready to respond in a better way when some other challenge comes along later. So I don't think it's a stretch based on some of the science we know already. And we used to joke about, you know, if you do the hot tubs as a 16-year-old, are you going to live longer? And we can joke about it, but we actually should start thinking about, well, what would be good things to measure in response to acute stress that might indicate successful aging later on? And I think that's where the problem at the moment lies. We don't have good biomarkers of aging. We don't have predictive markers early in life or in midlife that tell you how things are going to play out. Because if you did, you could test a whole bunch of things early in life, or you could look at the whole plethora of lifestyle choices that people make early in life, Measure those biomarkers and say, you know what, this is going to play out badly, this is going to play out very well. And what the people like Nir Barzilai and others studying centenarian populations will tell us is there's no one way to age successfully. There are multiple different ways in which you can become a centenarian. And so what are we lacking? We're lacking the intermediate things that we can measure. We need the biomarkers, or the gerometrics, as my colleague Simon Mello calls them, the gerometrics that we can measure that are predictive of late life. Then we could come back to your question. Then we could say, what would you do now? What would you do in early life to stress or challenge the system in order to derive benefits later on?
Yeah, because I this may be a naive question, but if you go to a doctor's office now, they might measure something like C-reactive protein and so on as measures of inflammation.
Yes.
It's not, is it clear to you that inflammation is necessarily a bad thing at that point, or is it something that, again, you want to produce as a kind of a challenge at the appropriate time in life?
That's right, and I think that a distinction is often made between acute inflammation and chronic inflammation, and the benefits of acute inflammation, of course, in fighting infection, and the detrimental effects of perceived chronic inflammation, and also this notion of sterile inflammation, where we have inflammatory processes without a challenge. And there's a great sea of conversation about this at the moment, and you see that inflammation is at the heart of a lot of age-related disease conditions. And you start to see that some of the pathways that are coming out of the model systems in more complex animals affect inflammatory states. And I think there's something to that. I'm watching, I'm a spectator on the sidelines of that story, and I think it's very exciting.
Well, you're at the Buck Institute, you have all these colleagues. You could, as Simon says, possibly the whole direction should be to produce this suite of gerometric measures,
yes,
which would be used as appropriately timed challenges for extending healthy lifespan.
It's entirely possible.
Well, let's see if it works. It was great talking to you, Gordon. Thanks very
much. Pleasure talking to you too. Thank you.